security and too much stability and too much tranquility and just too much, then what happens is a human being becomes vain. And I mean, there is a lot of truth to this. So when everything is going our way and everything is just rosy and, you know, the world is just perfect, then we start to slip. We start to relax, right? We might not read our salah. We might not read the Quran anymore. We might not thank Allah. We might not be humble in front of Allah. Why? Well, because we have everything that we want. So why worry about all these other things, such as reading the Quran or reading supplications or doing the salah on time? Meaning a certain kind of arrogance and a certain kind of vanity overcomes us and our hearts. And so this security and tranquility, and because this is a translation from Arabic, we kind of have to understand what the context is. So this doesn't mean, you know, by security, it doesn't mean go and live in like a war zone. No, this security means that as an individual, you feel like you are safe from, for example, the fires of hell and the disobedience of Allah. This is the security that's being talked about. And tranquility, this doesn't mean that we should live, you know, a difficult, pauper life and, you know, make sure that our life is always unstable and chaotic. No, here by tranquility, what it really means is that, you know, as an individual, we should not feel like, you know, just put your legs up on the table type thing and everything is okay, there's no problem, you know, I don't need to worry about, you know, my prayers, I don't need to worry about my hereafter. It's kind of this negligence more than tranquility. And of course, as Imam Ali says, if this kind of security in this meaning and this kind of tranquility in this meaning overtakes a person's heart, in result, it will become arrogant, it will become vain, and of course, it will become ruined. Profound and very deep and beautiful lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرضه.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away, and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you.
Every فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Whilst inside the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the visitor is recommended to busy themselves and engage with the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether it's through the recitation of the Quran or through a number of important supplications, invocations, and ziyaras. That indeed establish this connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt. Here, for example, we are in the sahan, or the courtyard, so to speak, of Sayyida Fatima within the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And a visitor here is recommended to recite a number of supplications and ziyaras. One could recite Dua al-Sabah, the supplication for the morning from Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Or Ziyarat Ashura, Ziyarat Warith, Ziyarat al-Jami' al-Kabira, Hadith al-Kisa, Dua Kumail ibn Ziyad, Dua al-Nudba, Dua al-Samat, Dua al-Tawassul, the Munajat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. This and many other supplications are highly recommended. But of course, one of the most crucial is one that is referred to as Ziyarat Aminullah. Now this ziyarah is not only specific for the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, but for every one of the ma'sumin, whether it's in Madinatul Munawwara, whether it is in Najaf, Karbala, Kadhimain, Mashhad, or in Samarra. We are recommended to recite Ziyarat Aminullah, which is an authentic ziyarah, established and one that is from the fourth holy Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin al-Sajjad, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. Now this ziyarah is key because it's made up of two segments. The first is the greeting of the Imam, alayhi salam. The second is a supplication to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, when we recite this ziyarah and any others, it is crucial that we recite it in Arabic, but also to try and figure out and ascertain its meaning in our own languages too. For example, if it is English or any other language, let's read the translation and reflect on the words. Assalamu alayka ya Amin Allahi fi ardih. Peace and blessings be upon you, O the one who is entrusted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his vicegerent on his earth. Ashhadu annaka jahadta fillahi haqqa jihadih. I bear witness that you struggled in the path of Allah in the best possible way. وَعَمِلْتَ بِكِتَابِهِ And you worked to establish the teachings of Allah through the Holy Quran. وَاتَّبَعْتَ سُنَنَ نَبِيِّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ And you followed the teachings and the path of his Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him and his holy progeny. حَتَّى دَعَاكَ اللَّهُ إِلَى جِوَارِهِ فَقَبَضَكَ إِلَيْهِ بِاخْتِيَارِهِ Until Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala raised you towards him and made you in his proximity.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Zaglam, Istanbul.
Syed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime. to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment, and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil, or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
An on-release report commissioned by the UK's Home Office lays the blame for the Windrush scandal, which saw hundreds of citizens from the Commonwealth wrongly detained, denied legal rights and in some cases deported from the UK, squarely at the feet of unjust laws that deliberately target people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Officials have so far refused to make the report public, much to the ire of lawyers like Jacqueline McKenzie, who represents a sizable number of Windrush victims. She's threatening to challenge the Home Office on behalf of her clients.
We all have a right to know what's in this report. Why is it a secret? It's predicated on a need to establish what caused the Windrush scandal, to make sure that we never go there again, and also to right the wrongs. And if we can't see it, then it suggests something very sinister is going on.
The Home Office says it's making progress to becoming an open and compassionate organization. But for those who have to deal with the fallout of their racist legislation, they're finding it hard to reconcile that statement with their own experiences.
We got to this position after 30, 40 years of racist immigration policy, building one on top of the other, until the point now where we probably have the most discriminatory and draconian racist immigration legislation anywhere outside of Israel.
Despite thousands coming to settle from former British colonies, immigration laws, it seemed, favoured a certain type of immigrant, a trend that continues into today with the announcement that the UK will fast-track graduates from the top 50 universities, none of them in Africa, the Caribbean or Latin America.
We see that privileges were given to other groups of people, particularly people from what was described as the old Commonwealths. And effectively, there was going to be white people from Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and white South Africans, you know. So racist ideology has always underpinned this. Remember when the Windrush boat itself was outside the Tilbury docks, a Labour Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, was actually considering sending that boat around. Remember, that's the 22nd of June, 1948.
Things are set to get worse.
Secretary now has the power to strip you of your citizenship, whether you're British born or not, and have you summarily shipped out the country. So not only are they not fixing all that was wrong with Windrush, they are actually giving themselves more power to commit more of the similar sorts of abuses without being in contrary of the law.
Hopefully forcing the Home Office to publish the so far secretive report will lay bare Britain's immigration practices for all to see. This in the hope that deep scrutiny means there can be no further repeats. Amina Taylor, London.
Shaking hands of friendship in Tehran. Tajikistan's president, Imam Ali Rahman, is on a two-day trip to Iran upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Ibrahim Raisi. The first day was the busiest day, which saw the two sides signing cooperation documents in a range of fields, from energy and environment to tourism and urban development.
Today, Mr. President's visit to Iran and the signing of the new MOUs between the two countries will definitely bring about a giant leap in the two sides' relations.
Today, we also followed up on the implementation of agreements signed earlier in Tajikistan that draw the roadmap for Iran and Tajikistan's economic and political cooperation until 2030.
The two sides also talked on regional developments, both sharing the same stance that Afghanistan needs to be ruled by an all-inclusive government.
Establishing a broad-based government in Afghanistan that includes all ethnic and social groups is essential to promoting peace and stability in that country.
20 years of NATO and U.S. presence in Afghanistan has had no outcome other than war, bloodshed, and destruction, and the future of Afghanistan must be determined by the people of Afghanistan themselves.
Tajikistan has been a strong supporter of Iran's full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the SCO. In September last year, the Tajik president invited Raisi to his country when Iran was finally approved as a full member of the SCO, a major bloc of Asian states that was launched in 2001 by China, Russia, and Central Asian republics, with the goal of promoting cooperation in politics, trade, and economy.
In the early days of my 10 years as president, I traveled to Tajikistan both to take part in the Shanghai summit and to visit Tajikistan. That trip was a turning point in the two countries' ties, so that today we have witnessed a fourfold increase in our bilateral trade.
Despite their historical, linguistic, cultural and religious commonalities, Tehran and Dushanbe have not maintained a remarkable trade partnership. In 2020, the trade volume between the two countries was around $57 million, down from a high of $300 million in 2013. Raisi's last year visit to Tajikistan paved the way for a surge in the two sides' economic ties, pushing the annual trade up fivefold to $130 million. The two set a target of $500 million for annual bilateral trade, despite the challenges of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Closer ties with neighbors has been on top of Ibrahim Raisi's agenda since he took office almost a year ago, as part of his ambitions to untie his country's economy from the fate of the 2015 deal. As a country that shares many concerns and commonalities with Iran, Tajikistan is on the same page with Tehran to open a new chapter in their partnership. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Some 30,000 Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim slogans as part of what's known by Israel as the Flag March that takes place annually to celebrate its occupation of the eastern parts of the Holy City in 1967. Thousands also marched through the Muslim quarter of the old town of Al-Quds amid security deployment and restrictions against the Palestinians. Clashes broke out at the Bab al-Amud, known also as the Damascus Gate, multiple times ahead of the march. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces.
Israel is conducting a very dangerous policy. They are trying to impose the annexation of East Jerusalem, which presents a very serious violation of international law. The only way to stop the Israelis is to resist their actions, but also it is required from the whole international community to impose sanctions on Israel.
At the same time, Palestinians held counter rallies across the occupied territories, waving the Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said, although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site.
By allowing the settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Israeli regime is trying to divert attention from its internal conflict and shift attention to the Judaization of Al-Quds. But it will fail because Al-Quds always unites all the Palestinian people. Today, we're all united for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Ahead of the march, in the morning, some 2,500 settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in groups of 40 to 50 under the protection of Israeli forces. Following that, Palestinian worshippers were attacked and forced out of the compound by the regime forces.
Some around the world could argue that it's only a flag parade and nothing more. But for Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation, domination, and seizure of their right to exist on their homeland. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
It was planned as a friendly soccer match, but turned into a political dispute. Canada has unilaterally pulled out of a World Cup warm-up match it had planned with Iran on June 5th in Vancouver. Citing, quote, untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran, the Canadian footballing body Canada Soccer called off the match, which had sold 40,000 tickets already. Here in Iran, the move has created a whirlwind, with Iranian sports authorities calling it illegal and unsporting.
Sportsmanship and fairness is a fundamental principle in sports. Canada's decision to unilaterally cancel the fixture violates the principle. On the other hand, the move has tarnished Canada's image on the world's athletic stage, because no one would trust a country that has apathetically scrapped a formal contract.
The Iranian team was slated to arrive in Canada on Wednesday to take part in the exhibition match. Canada Soccer had said it chose Iran because the team had a similar playing style to Morocco, one of Canada's opponents in the Qatar FIFA World Cup. But aside from missing this rare chance, Canada Soccer now has to pay the financial costs of the sold-out tickets.
It seems that Canada's unilateral cancellation of its match with Iran will produce more long-term ripple effects, as there are financial dimensions to it, not to mention the legal ramifications. Iran has now decided to sue Canada for breach of contract and, quote, politicizing sports.
Canada Soccer backtracked from holding the fixture days after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau criticized the federation for their decision to invite Iran. Tehran says this further reveals how Canada's sport is influenced by political decisions.
It's a pity that a country like Canada, which claims to be committed to the separation of politics from sports, so openly disregards this principle and mixes up political hostilities against Iran with the sport. It's definitely a violation of the FIFA regulations.
Tehran has now warned of legal consequences. Iranian sports authorities say they're arranging their complaint to FIFA to seek at least $10 million in damages.
Our colleagues at the Iranian Football Federation are following up on the legal pursuit of the case. We are currently writing to the Canadian Soccer Association to seek a convincing answer regarding why they committed such a move. We will then take the case to FIFA to seek psychological and financial compensation for Canada's illegal action.
Iran says it will move forward with its lawsuit against Canada's Soccer Association to question its eligibility to host 2026 FIFA World Cup. So it seems Canada's costly decision is unfolding into many unthought-of consequences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Bouriza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Americans have a gun-crazy culture, armed to the teeth, with some believing that they are the true patriots defending liberty against tyranny, says James Zogby, author, in an article published under the heading, The U.S. is Sick with Guns. Stay tuned for more. It's difficult to find words that adequately describe feelings on first learning of the massacre of 19 children and two teachers in Texas recently. There was shock, fear, even nausea, and then disgust at the realization that this nightmare Americans have experienced too many times before was playing out again. As expected, the next day's papers were filled with graphs and charts showing how many mass shootings Americans have had in the United States of America, an average of one a day. How many school massacres Americans have had in the past few decades? Dozens. How many gun homicides? 50 a day. And how many guns are owned by American civilians? More than 400 million. Bottom line, Americans own more guns and have a higher per capita murder rate and mass casualty events annually by far than any other country on planet Earth. No matter how many times Americans are told this and how many outrages they endure, Americans know in their hearts that nothing will be done. And so they are resigned to live with fear, knowing the nightmare will return in their lives. Let's face it, the U.S. is a sick country. Their debate on gun violence can best be described as deranged and pathetic. Republicans and Democrats, fearful of getting in the crosshairs of the gun lobby, refuse to take any action. They refuse to allow even limited controls on guns, arguing that the unfettered right to own weapons is sacred. The solution to gun violence, they argue, is more guns. Having seen legislation to ban assault weapons or place limits on gun purchases routinely defeated, Democrats have either given up trying or being reduced to offering weak proposals. The result? Each new tragedy gives birth to short-lived horror, a bit of finger-pointing, a half-hearted attempt to pass some limited reforms, and then failure. The reality is deeper than policies or legislation. It's not just that American guns are too sophisticated or that they have too many of them. The root problem is the U.S. sick gun culture. U.S. generations grew up playing cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers. If they didn't have cap pistols or toy rifles, they simply improvised with a pointed finger, a thumb trigger, and po-po, you're dead. American generations do not play these games. Instead, they act out more fanciful tales of fantasy futuristic heroes, all possessing more potent weapons. But they will also make do when needed, with sticks or fingers morphing them into weapons possessed of all sorts of destructive powers. And the video games they play and movies they watch are largely based on killing, killing and killing, so much so that it has become normalized. From cradle to grave, Americans are fed a steady diet of guns and violence. From cartoons, westerners or cop shows to video games and Quentin Tarantino's Bullet and Blood Fist, guns and shooting and killing are ingrained into their deep culture. Like mom and apple pie, guns have become part of who Americans are as a nation. There is a scene in the film Noir called Classic Gone Crazy where Bart, the film's main character as a young boy, is starting into a store window. The object of his desire is a six-shooter. Unable to resist its call, he shatters the glass and attempts to steal the weapon, only to be arrested in the act. The next scene has Bart standing before a judge trying to explain his obsession with guns. He tells the court, "I feel good when I'm shooting them. I feel awful, good inside, like I'm somebody." Gone Crazy Bart's fixation with the weapon is pathological, and it leads ultimately to his demise. when we see the look on the faces of gun enthusiasts lining up to make what they fear may be their last purchase before Democrats take their guns away, we think of Bart. When we watch them sensually cradling their assault weapons or zoomed out at the shooting range, we think of Bart, knowing that nothing good can come of it. We know all this, and yet there continues to be a pathological obsession not only with owning weapons, but also with blocking any reasonable controls on their ownership. The modus operandi of this lobby is simple and direct. They allow no discussion, no compromise, no concessions, and no wavering or weakness. And they mask their deadly advocacy with the Constitution, arguing that what is at stake is the very survival of Americans' freedom. In the process, they further inflame the passions of their adherents. In the end, the U.S. has a gun-crazy culture, armed to the teeth, with some believing that they are the true patriots defending liberty against tyranny. When we add to this mix all of the resentments and pressures that gave birth to the Tea Party and Trumpism, including a not-so-subtle appeal to race, Americans are left with a dangerous and volatile brew. They will have more angry debates. They may pass some weak and ineffective legislation, and then they will move on to another issue that will distract Americans until the next massacre occurs. And another one will occur, because until they have a prolonged and serious national discussion about their sick love affair with guns and purge themselves of this pathology, they will only be skirting around the edges of an issue that is killing American civilians.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and the most important works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyania. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyania, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding figure originally from region Jebel Amel in Lebanon. He is no one but Sayyid Muhsin al-Amin al-Husseini al-Ameli, the author of the magnum opus Ayan al-Shia. Sheikh Ziyania, let's start with you, brother. First, give us a detailed background or information about the early life and biography of Sayyid Muhsin al-Amin al-Husseini al-Ameli.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhsin Amin Husseini al-Ameli was born in 1284 in a village of Jabal Amel in the country of Lebanon. And as his name is showing, he's Sayyid. He is from the generation of the Holy Prophet and his offspring. And his lineage goes back to Zayd ibn Ali, the son of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam. Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Amin moved from his village to Najaf al-Ashraf to start his Islamic studies. And he studied in Najaf up to the point that he achieved the degree of ijtihad. We should mention that also his father was a clergyman,
yes,
and was amongst the scholars at his time.
Abdul Karim al-Amili.
Yes, Abdul Karim al-Amili.
Yes.
And he studied, for example, Arabic grammar and logic and yes, things like this, the, yes, you know, introductory studies at his village. And then he moved to Najaf al-Ashraf at the age of at the year of 1308, according to lunar calendar after Hijrah. And in that city, I mean Najaf, he got benefit from the knowledge of great scholars like Mullah Hussein Quli Hamadani, rahmatullah alayh, Muhammad Hassan Mawmaghani, rahmatullah alayh, and Akhund Khurasani, rahmatullah alayh. And we should also notice that he was good in poem, and he was able to compose poems.
That's right.
And he had a number of students like Sayyid Amin, M. Sayyid Ali Ahmed Husseini Amili, Sheikh Munir Asayran, and many other scholars.
That's right. Very good introduction. What is known, Sheikh Mahdavi, about Sayyid Mohsen al-Amin al-Amili is that he was a socio-religious and cultural reformer of his time, up to an extent that whenever there was a misunderstanding, doubt, or misconception regarding the Shia Islam, he was on the front line to answer or to be active in the scene, practically speaking. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of the life, and then we'll get, inshallah, to Shia, his magnum opus, which is really outstanding, one of the most outstanding books regarding the Shia history.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, this is one of the nice aspects of his life that I believe that must be studied more and more, because regarding the ulama, most of the time we have outstanding works, but when it comes to practice, when it comes to the way of life or lifestyle, the way we can take them as our role model, I think it's a kind of practical aspect of their life that must be studied. What you raised is a good point, and we have to say that Sayyid Mohsen Amin, he himself, in his autobiography, at the end of his book, A'yanu Shi'a, he says that after I finished my study in Najaf, I was invited to Damascus, because they are considered as a Shamat land. All
the Syria, great Levant.
Yes.
Yes.
Lebanon and Syria, yes, they're considered from one category in the tribes of the ethnicity. So he was invited to Damascus. He goes there, and as he also continues, he says that I was like a physician. The way a physician goes around the people, try to analyze their illnesses and sickness, I was coming across with many cultural, social illness among the people in terms of the way they are practicing religion, the way they are living. So he says that I can classify their illness, I mean these mental illness and cultural illness,
right,
into three categories. First of all, lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. I realize that youth are not paying attention to knowledge, and half of the youth, which are girls, are deprived. So he had a very significant role in establishing and founding schools. Mm-hmm. That nowadays one school which was initially founded by him is actually named Al-Madrasatul Muhsaniya, in memory of his name, Sayyid Mohsen Amin. And that's that was one of the schools that the king of Syria, he acknowledged when he met the school and visited different parts of the school.
Okay.
He was really surprised by this type of administration in the school. And they said, he asked, who is the principal of this school? And when he founded that, Sayyid Mohsen Amin, one scholar who is at the level of ijtihad, is a principal of the school, he was really astonished by the type of his administration. So he says, one of the first thing is lack of knowledge. Second thing is making parties and segregation among Shia themselves. Mm-hmm. As we see even in Lebanon and Syria, we have different parties among Shia themselves,
that's
which
right,
lead to disunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing is...
you mean bringing different denominations, even inside Islam, all together?
Yes, not Islam, and even the Shia itself.
Okay, the
Shia
itself.
Because if it was
that's
Islam,
right,
that is something that we might say from the beginning, we had something like that. But these political parties, political parties that which lead into segregation and disunity among the people, and it is all against the people.
Mm-hmm.
and in favor of politicians.
That's right.
So he says the third thing that I wanted to resist against and do a kind of reform against it was the misdeed and distortion that were placed into the procession and the practices of mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And we know how it is difficult to resist against the customs of the people if they are rooted in people but not in correspondence with the religion and reason.
Some deviated rituals and customs for Imam al-Hussein, like self-torturing or self, for example,
or tatbir, what hitting, they call it.
Yes, you know, they were just rampant among the people, and Sayyid Mosallamin was among the first people who opposed them. And historically speaking,
yes,
and according to authentic resources, he negated and rejected such deviated, we can say, customs amongst some of the minorities of the Shias.
And
that's,
we see,
right,
even nowadays, if you, in some communities, if you talk ill against this tatbir, you see there might be some negative
attacks,
resistance,
or, yes,
and against,
resistance, that's right,
against you. But what is the reality? The reality, when we look at this tatbir or practicing tatbir among Shia community over the 10 days of the Muharram, we see the picture that will be portrayed to the world from Imam Hussein, how it's going to be a harsh picture.
Bloody picture, that's right. So, and unfortunately, nowadays, for example, in the Google, when you Google Imam al-Hussein and Ashura,
first thing first,
the first pictures and the first images are this, but this is not the true face of Imam al-Hussein and the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So he was a socio-religious reformer, I can call it, we can say, on that time. And I think, thank you, Sheikh Mahdavi, I think Sheikh Ziyaniya compiling the book Ayyanu Shia was also, we can say, the continuation of such reviving or reformation among the Shia beliefs, and in an answer to, we can say, the negations and the misunderstandings about the Shia Imams and the Shia history, isn't it? So talk a little bit about the main, we can say, intention or goal of Sayyid Mohsen al-Amin al-Ameli in compiling such a book, Ayyanu Shia.
Of course, because his main book is Ayyanu Shia, so we should talk about this book. Regarding this book, we should mention that as its name is clarifying, the subject is Ayyanu Shia, and it means the noble people amongst Shia.
Among Shias, or the noblest Shias, because
So one of the first questions that come to my mind is that, okay, so why he has to compile such a book? To continue the discussion of my brother Sheikh Mahdavi, I should mention this issue that, okay, when you want to reform a society and to give them their identity, they are in need of knowing their history. If they do not know themselves, so then they are not proud of themselves.
Yes.
So because of this, Allama Sayyid Mohsen Amin decides to compile the history of Shia, the dignitaries of Shia, and the people who have dedicated their life to serve the, not only Shia, but the
Islam,
religion of Islam.
Original Islam.
That's why at the beginning of his book, he gives the history of the life of the Holy Prophet and then Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam.
That's right.
But it's about 2 volumes of his book, but about 8 or 10 volumes, according to different editions, he talks about the noble figures among Shia.
That's right.
Like scholars, scientists, those people who have served, or they were poets, or people that they have done, you know, social services.
You mean the muhaddisin, mufassirin?
Yeah, different fields of study.
Faqis, that's right. So, it's better to say that Ayyanu Shia is an encyclopedia of the life account of the Shia infallible imams, I mean the Ma'sumin, and then the generation after that. It could be followers, it could be, for example, the students, the most outstanding scholars or knowledgeable men of the Shia world.
Sure, yeah. This is, you know, if you want to talk about the figures and you want to know, for example, about mathematics. Do we have any scholar in Shia? In the Shia history?
Yes.
We may refer to Ayyanu Shia and find. Or, for example, about
Arabic grammar, Arabic semantic, or, for example, metaphors.
That's right.
These different, fields, medics, these different fields of study, every single different field of study, he talks about it, I mean, Sayyid Mohsen Amin, yes, in this book, Ayan al-Shia, and explains about these scholars that they have done services regarding that field of study. Right. And okay, I should mention that this book is compiled according to alphabetical order.
Yes.
And the writer, I mean, Sayyid Mohsen Amin, mentions the name of this scholar,
okay,
his time, the city in which he was living, the country in which he was living, and a biography of him.
That's right. Okay. It is really, it must be an outstanding work, I think. I think it is really interesting if someone translate the whole book into English language. I don't know if it has been translated into English language or not.
Some parts of it has been translated into Farsi.
Okay.
But, I mean, the lives of Ahlul Bayt, yes, wasalam, has been translated into Farsi by Dr. Ayati, late Dr. Ayati.
That's right.
And okay, I should mention that about 12,000 names, 12,000 entries are mentioned in this book.
Oh, 12,000 entries about the most outstanding people of the Shia regarding different fields. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, anything missed about A'yan al-Shia? I mean, his method of research or something like that? It must be very much difficult, that at the same time, I think his method is very much novel, because with referring to the volumes of this book, which is in alphabetical order and make it very much easy for the researcher, you can be familiar with different people and the life account during the history of the Shia world, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but maybe some may consider some of the points that must be modified if someone wants to benefit more and more from this compilation of the books, that sometimes that comprehensiveness that you may expect from the book might not be available for some of the entries. Sometimes you see the actually repeating entries under different names that the reader must be noticed when he is going through the text, and sometimes the coherence of the text is not respected or actually,
of course, in today's world and with today's research method, I mean, computer-based ones, it is very much easy to decide and judge, we can say. But on that time, you know, more than 12,000 entries on a paper note, it was really difficult.
Yeah, and that's why we see that his son, Sayyid Hassan Amin, because of these points, he tries to complete. So the complementary book for this is regarded Mustadrak Ayan al-Shi'a. So we can
have
this,
such a book too.
Yes, Mustadrak Ayan al-Shi'a, have it. So if we put these two together, we are going to benefit from the huge body of information and data regarding the Ayan al-Shi'a, or
that's
the dignified authors and influential figures of Shia.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia, for a nice elaboration on the life of Sayyid Mohsen al-Amin al-Husseini al-Amali, the author of Ayan al-Shi'a. Rajab 4, 1371, according to the Hijra calendar, is a day that he passed away in Damascus. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Zainab in Syria, Damascus, and he is buried. And may Allah give us the chance of paying a visit or homage to the holy shrine of Hazrat Zainab in Damascus, inshallah, one day, me and all the followers of the Shia world. And really, may Allah bless the soul of such great protectors of the legacy of the Shia world and the Shia history, inshallah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode introducing another Shia dignitary, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
www.parstoday.com/EN What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.